invited me also to give a talk and also for having organized this conference. It's a pleasure to come here at the Perimeter after quite a few years, actually. So we'll tell you something about collapse models. There are quite several talks during this meeting about these models, and I will try to make a sort of overview and stress in some conceptual points, and also mainly talking about the phenomenology, about experiments, a little bit as the title suggests. So the motivation behind collapse models, I guess, is kind of known to the community. There is the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. The theory is linear, so you have superpositions. They are okay at the microscopic level. They pose problems at the macroscopic level, so you have Schrödinger's cat, and you know, people are puzzled about the meaning of a wave function of a super describing a superposition of two different macroscopic states. Collapse models avoid this problem by changing the dynamical evolution, introducing nonlinear stochastic terms in such a way that you don't have macroscopic superpositions. If you try to create one, the nonlinear terms forbid you doing so. Or if you want to put it in a suggestive way, as John Bell once wrote, collapses are something that occur not only at the end of the measurement process, but more or less every time, more or less everywhere, more or less for every physical system. They are mild, kind of negligible for microscopic system, and then because of an amplification mechanism I will tell you about, they become more and more relevant towards the macroscopic scale. But first, I mean, I'd like to start with a general comment. So suppose we don't know much about collapse models. We have just the idea of modifying the Schrödinger equation, and then you would raise the question, how can I modify the Schrödinger equation? There is a trivial answer to this question, any way you want, as long as it's compatible with experimental data. But there is perhaps a more interesting way to pose the question. In which way can one modify the Schrödinger equation while respecting some general requirements, physical requirements, which you wouldn't give up? And then the question becomes more interesting, and also the answer becomes somehow more interesting. And now I will try to argue that indeed, there is only one reasonable way to modify the evolution as given by the Schrödinger equation, which is the way in which collapse models do it. So in this sense, which I will make precise now, collapse models are the alternative theory. I mean, they are models in a way, but they are the alternative, not one of the many, the alternative to quantum theory, against which the theory can be tested experimentally also. So how does the argument work? So let's start with the mixtures of states, psi I or phi I, with probability pi or qi. So you know that two mixtures are equivalent if they form the same density matrix. So given this definition, let's consider a generic evolution operator for the wave function. It's not a unitary evolution given by the Schrödinger equation, it's any. What we have in mind are collapse models, so it's a nonlinear and stochastic evolution, but we can try to be a little bit more general and consider any dynamics here. And let's see which kind of constraints we can put on it. So the first important remark is that in general, for a generic evolution, the equivalence relation between a statistical mixtures is not preserved. If you have two initially equivalent mixtures, after some time, because of the evolution E, they are not equivalent anymore. So this means that, again, in general, the density matrix formalism is not suitable for describing a physical system if E is the dynamic, because you would have, for initial density matrix, depending on the unraveling, you would have different evolutions, so you would have a one-to-many correspondence. So it's not a good dynamics. And there is no big deal in principle. You keep working the wave function, you derive everything from the wave function, so nothing to really worry about. But then comes into play an argument put forward by Gizen some years ago in 1989, which I guess some of you at least know. Consider the following situation. It's a typical one, Alice and Bob, which play with entangled states. And they have particles which are produced by a common source, then they move in opposite direction towards Alice and Bob, and they make measurements, and they are entangled in some internal degrees of freedom. Well, there is a piece of mathematics which tells you that whichever mixtures you have of states psi I or phi I with probability pi or qi, then you can always find an enlarged Hilbert space and two sets of orthogonal states, alpha I and beta I, on this new Hilbert space, such that the entangled state written there can be prepared. Something quite known in the literature. Then Alice decides to make measurements. And in particular, she measures either the observable A, which has the states alpha I as eigenstates, or the observable B, which has the states beta I as eigenstates. And then, in this way, Bob gets two equivalent mixtures, either the state psi I or the state phi I with the correct, with the initial probability pi or qi. So, simple remark, According to quantum mechanics, you can prepare equivalent mixtures at a distance. But now Bob, instead of measuring the system, waits some time for the evolution E of t to pick up and to change the state of the system significantly. And then the following thing happens, that if the evolution E of t does not preserve the equivalence relation among density matrices, then you easily realize that a faster-than-light protocol can be prepared for communication. So that's basically the requirement which was stressed by Gizan the first time, that if you want to preserve the no superluminal condition, then the evolution, whatever the evolution for the wave function is, must preserve the equivalence relation among statistical mixtures. If you have that, then you can define in a good way, in a good mathematical way, an evolution equation over density matrices, because then starting from E evolution of the wave function, you can defy T evolution of the density matrices, because the evolution E is independent of the mixture in which you unravel the initial density matrix. This dynamics T for the density matrix has to be linear because of the very structure, the very meaning of the density matrix. Here there is, I mean, a simple proof, but it's easy to see that the evolution is linear. And then consequence number three, if you add also the quantum dynamical semigroup assumption, which is basically the Markovian evolution and complete positivity, you know that this linear evolution for the density matrix has to be of the Lindblad type. So the moral so far basically is that if you ask for non-superluminal signaling for your evolution of the wave function, then whatever the evolution is, at the level of the density matrix, it has to give rise to a Lindblad type of equation, given also some these other further mathematical requirements, but the only real physical condition is the no faster than light condition. So this is known in the literature. So the question then is the following one. Yes?
Isn't Markovian itself a strong physical?
Yeah, it is. Indeed, it is. No, you're right. You're correct. Also, Markovianity is a strong requirement. Well, the easy answer is that if you go beyond the Markovian assumption, you cannot prove anything in a way. Another possible answer, which I don't like so much, but I give it to you, is that if all fundamental equations of nature somehow so far prove to be Markovian. So far. So it doesn't mean that in the future they have to be like this. I wouldn't bet on that. But seems that,
that's certainly not true for reduced.
No, fundamental. I'm saying fundamental equations, so Maxwell equation, Newton's laws, Schrödinger equation, Einstein's equations. Reduced equations, certainly. Most of them are non-Markovian, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just curious, I mean, this is a long discussion, don't answer it now, but at various attempts to do relativistic versions of the GRW theory, like Roddy Pamulka's,
yep,
aren't Markovian.
Is it a question or a statement? Because I never really studied the model, I must say.
Yeah, no, it's not Markovian.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds like you're getting ready here to use the requirement of Markovianism, yeah, to zero us in on.
No, I mean, I don't want to be misunderstood. The only reason why I talked about Markovian evolution, because from the mathematical point of view, you cannot really prove anything in a good way if you give up the Markovian assumption. I'm not saying that the Markovian assumption is something really crucial. So in that sense, I would put it more on the mathematical side than physical, but only because of this, because otherwise you cannot do anything. I mean, Lindblad's theorem is easy because of the Markovian assumption. Then no one knows what to do, even for open quantum systems. So. But morally, I mean, it's only moral, nothing more than that. I think that this uniqueness somehow works also in the Markovian, non-Markovian case, but I would have no idea how to prove it, really no idea. So given this, let's try to phrase the problem in a kind of mathematical rigorous way. We take a general evolution equation for the wave function, which is nonlinear, and there you have the operators A and B, which are generic operators, not necessarily linear operators. It's also stochastic. There is a deterministic part, which is the first term, the drift, and there is a stochastic part, which is the second term. So it's a generic equation. There is the constraint of Markovianity, because these are Wiener processes. If they are general noises, again, you cannot derive anything mathematically. So given this general equation, the question would be, which kind of constraints can one put on A and B by requiring that the evolution for the density matrix is of the limblet type? And then there is a precise answer which can be given mathematically, which was reported in, I mean, in the literature before. And that's the answer. The operators A and B are almost uniquely identified as a function of the limblet operators L. You see that in A, in the drift term A, you have, this is the drift, you have the Hamiltonian. So when L is equal to zero, everything is zero, here we have quantum mechanics, standard Schrödinger equation, and then you have the new possibilities, and they are just functions of the operator L and nothing else. There is nothing free, except for here, a kind of unitary rotation of the limblet operators. So that's the only freedom.
The operator L case.
Oh, it's this one. So given this, so given also L, given the limblet structure also L, what's the condition? What's the constraint you put on A and B? So the L's are given by the limblet equation. And this kind of freedom is known in the literature, that there is a class of unraveling of the density matrix. But the point now is that the class is unique. So if you want to modify the Schrödinger equation respecting no faster than light signaling, you have to do it in such a way that at least in the Markovian limit, you get that structure. Nothing else would work. So in that sense, collapse models are the alternative with all these conditions, of course, the alternatives to quantum mechanics. So that's also a way, that a reason to that makes them interesting to analyze. Okay, but still, I mean, there is quite a bit of freedom. So first of all, there is this unitary freedom that I showed you before, which is a kind of not easy to explain, but basically you can go by rotating the operators in that way, you can go from no collapse at all. You just have a random potential, so a normal Schrödinger equation with a stochastic potential, to maximum collapse. And here, the equation I wrote here is just the one where you have the maximum amount of collapse. And I wrote it just for one operator, one self-adjoint operator, just to show you the structure in the easiest possible way. So the general structure is the one I showed you before. Here is the easy thing. And basically, again, what's the moral of this equation? Schrödinger. And these terms tell you that the wave function collapses to one of the eigenstates of the operator A. That's what these terms do, nothing more than that, with the Born rule. And it's also something interesting to learn from collapse models, is that the Born rule was never a requirement for deriving the equation. It comes out naturally from the dynamics. And if you want, one way to say that is the Born rule is the only probability rule compatible with the no faster than light requirement. Something interesting to learn about. But coming back to collapse models, the question then, basically you have the freedom in choosing the operators. So you can change the noise, and we will do that. We will go to no Markovian models. That you can change the noise, but mainly you can change the operator. So you can change the basis where you want to collapse the wave function. You can have a spin collapse models, and you collapse in spin, energy collapse models, you collapse in energy, and so on and so forth. But if you want to make sure that these models tell you that objects, microscopic objects, are localized in space the way we see them, the safest, the more reasonable way and simpler way is to choose the operators A as a position operator or as a function of the position operator. That's the most natural way to do collapse. And then you have space collapse models, which are basically the only one that people discuss in the literature, more or less, or they represent 95% of collapse models. And here you have a review. I made a review of the models that appear in the literature. I grouped them in two different ways. Here it's whether you have or you do not have dissipative effects. You know that it's one of the common feature of collapse models, which many people don't like, actually, is the a violation of the principle of energy conservation. Energy is not conserved because you have a noise which drives the system, which pumps energy into the system, and the system heats up like any noise does. And typically, like in the GRW CSL model, the noise increases, the energy increases with a constant rate and eventually diverges, even though with a very long times. But indeed, this is not a necessary feature of collapse models. You can make models where the energy goes to equilibrium, to a certain temperature. So the energy doesn't increase with the constant rate. Or actually, if the system initially has a higher energy than this equilibrium, the energy decreases and goes to equilibrium. So energy violation is a typical feature of collapse models, but not energy increase. Energy can decrease and still have a good collapse model, because the two things, collapse and energy violation, are not directly related to each other. They are connected, but not directly related. And or you can have white noise models or color noise models. And then, so the simplest models that were proposed in the literature were the easiest one from the mathematical point of view, white noise, no dissipation, quite easy to handle. And then the generalizations have been worked out. Different models, but from the qualitative point of view, they all do the same thing. They collapse, the wave function in space, and the larger the system, the faster the collapse.
Small collapse models have narrow time.
Depends on the way in which you consider collapse models. If you consider them somehow as the fundamental theory of nature, so to say, so quantum mechanics is almost correct. The really correct theories are collapse models. So that's the fundamental theory of nature. The answer is yes. These collapses induce a narrow time because initially pure state always evolves into a mixture, but a mixture never evolves back into a pure state. So you have a narrow time. If, on the other end, you consider collapse models as a phenomenological theory, where, for example, the collapse is driven by some sort of noise, then it would be like, for example, the situation of a particle in the gas. A particle in the gas has a narrow time, but because that's a phenomenological description. A classical particle, classical particle in the gas, it diffuses. So if it's initially, the probability distribution is localized, then it diffuses and it never goes back. But if you if you study the fundamental underlying theory, which is a classic Newtonian mechanics, it doesn't have a narrow time. So the answer depends really on what the status of collapse models is. I don't believe that the arrow of time is necessarily implicit into collapse models, because I don't believe they are fundamental models. I do believe that they are phenomenological models of an underlying time symmetric theory, and the two things are not in contradiction. Quantum mechanics with the universal position localization. That was just the name of the article.
Does the kind of thing that the kind of collapse theory that Penrose talks about fit into this chart anywhere?
No, I will show it in the last slide. Sure. No, actually. I mean, morally, yes, but I would say no.
On the other question about time symmetry, the time reversal invariance, could it depend also on how you pose the question? If you pose it not in terms of the wave function, but in terms of the kind of decoherence functional that Bill was presenting before, is it still true that it looks time reversal asymmetric? Because I think one of the motivations for looking at that kind of decoherence functional formulation was to have a sort of formally time symmetric way of writing quantum mechanics if you put both in an initial and final density matrix. So I'm just wondering what would happen here.
Well, I'm not sure what to answer, but I mean the dynamics is fundamentally time asymmetric. So the dynamical evolution. So even if you write the coherence functional, what would change?
Well, one might have said that just ordinary quantum mechanics was fundamentally time asymmetric because there's, the collapse refers to the later moment and so on. But if you take that formula that was written down before, and if you put a symmetric choice of initial and final conditions, then the probabilities are symmetric.
Okay. Yeah, but wouldn't you betray somehow the spirit of collapse models?
I don't know. I'm not so sure. Oh. I mean, I think that may be another way of thinking about collapse models. That it's a modification to the decoherence functional.
Yeah, but the fundamental ingredient would be the decoherence function, not the wave function anymore.
True. That be? But you can still build in the... That's true, but you can still... There's a precisely analogous modification of the decoherence functional,
okay,
which in fact you could derive from this other collapse model in the same way that was discussed earlier, deriving from unitary evolution the same decoherence functional formula.
Yeah, I have to think a bit more about that actually.
Okay.
So from the qualitative point of view, they are the same, but then they're different in a very significant way from the quantitative point of view. And that's important that when you want to compare these models with experimental data, and I will show you later. So I will refer to the CSL model, which is somehow the model that people most talk about, because I mean GRW and CSL in a way are similar. They are the same in some sense. And the QMUPL model can be considered as a simplified version of these models. Actually, there has been a recent article by Dürer and collaborators proving that the continuous limit of the GRW model is indeed a QMUPL model from a strictly mathematical point of view. And then these are just a generalization of the CSL models, roughly speaking. So we'll refer to the CSL model. CSL is continuous spontaneous localization, again, the title of the article. So this is the equation for the CSL model. And again, the structure is always the same. That now instead of one operator A, we have a continuum of operators, one for each point of space. And these operators are the particle density operator, which is a good way of describing position in a second quantized language. So it's a non-relativistic equation, but in the language of second quantization. So it collapses basically the wave function in space from the moral point of view. And then you have one Wiener process for each point of space. So you have a field over space-time. This field is delta correlated in time. They are Wiener processes, again, because otherwise mathematics would become very complicated. But they are Gaussianly correlated in space with the correlation length RC. And it's important that they are Gaussianly correlated and not delta correlated. If they were delta correlated in space, they would be disproven experimentally. So it's important there is a correlation length.
How would they be disproven?
Oh, they would destroy matter. So take a bound. So take, for example, the hydrogen atom. Immediately, the electron would be separated from the proton, for example. So it's like, you know, like the GRW model.
And
the energy would immediately go to infinite because of that. So in this phenomenological model, there are two parameters, the correlation length of the noise, RC, and the strength of the collapse, lambda. And now we'll tell you what they mean. Okay, so that's all about this model. So just have a look at the equation. That's it. It doesn't say much, I would say, if you don't work on with that. So the most important feature of collapse models is the collapse and the amplification mechanism within the collapse. So why? The bigger the system, the faster the collapse. And that's how it works. So take a superposition in space. Here plus there of a particle, an atom, a table, whatever you want. If the distance of the superposition is less than RC, then the collapse is there, but is mathematically is there, but physically is ineffective. In one way to see it is that the noise doesn't really see a superposition because it's too short, so there is basically no collapse. The collapse becomes effective when the superposition, the distance of the two terms of the superposition is bigger than RC. And then in this case, the rate goes, well, the precise mathematical formula is very complicated. This is just a rule of thumb formula, which is good in most situations. The rate for the system is a capital gamma equal to lambda, the collapse rate for one particle, for one constituent, for one nucleon, for example, times small n squared and capital N times capital N squared. Where small n and capital N are computed in the following way. You take your object, like a table. You see how many nucleons stay within a sphere of radius RC. So that's the measure of the density of the object. And that makes small n. And then, you take the object, and you see how many such spheres you can put within the object somehow, within the shape of the object. So it's a measure of the volume. And that makes capital N. So the first point is that, again, that's the most important feature of collapse models. The bigger the system, the faster the collapse, which means that you can set lambda in such a way that for an atom, for a nucleon, for a small molecule, the collapse effect is negligible. Basically, you just have the usual quantum dynamics. But when you move to the macroscopic scale, so you increase the size of the system, the collapse rate for the center of mass of the wave function becomes stronger and stronger. So quantum mechanics for microscopic system effective collapse, classical behavior for macroscopic objects. So this is the way in which these models describe in unified way quantum properties and classical properties, and also the transition from quantum to classical. And in fact, the title of the JLW paper, the first paper on collapse models, was Unified Description of Global Micro and Macroscopic Systems, something like that.
Can I just wrap up these premises right here? The total number of particles in the object is little n times big N, is that right?
No. It's not directly dependent on that. So you see how many n would be a small n in this sense? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, let me think. Yeah, it's morally the same.
So we're thinking of an object with little n times big N particles in a superposition of two possible states, which are well separated compared to RC. And then your formula.
Yes. So this distance is bigger than RC.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would always, I mean, morally, again, this is a rule of thumb.
I thought big N represented the number of possible superpositions.
No.
There's always two.
Big N here is four. So this is your object, your macroscopic object, your table. And you see how many such circles you can put here in two dimensions, the circle. How many circles fit in the object?
But there are only two positions.
Yeah, there are always only two positions.
Oh.
No, I'm talking about, I mean, you can also analyze the situation with more superpositions, but here it's only two for simplicity. Always a superposition here plus there. But then the rate depends on what type of system is in the superposition.
And you said this is the rate of collapse for the center of mass
of the object.
How about the internal degrees of freedom of the system?
The internal degree.
Does the chair collapse here and also its arms and its legs, or only the center of mass?
So the interaction with the noise, means always collapse because it's a nonlinear interaction, goes also for the internal motion, but with the important difference. For the center of mass, there is the amplification mechanism. So the bigger the system, the stronger the effect. For the internal motion, instead, it goes with the microscopic parameters. So, for example, if you take the evolution of the relative coordinate of two protons in your system, that's a collapse type of equation, but where the collapse part has the microscopic value for lambda, which changes the quantum dynamics a little bit, but not in an appreciable way. So also the internal motion is effectively modified, but not in a significant way. So I don't know, if you take, for example, a diamond, then the vibration would become slightly stronger because of the collapse effect, but not in a detectable way. The only thing that you would detect is if you create a superposition, diamond here plus diamond there, then you couldn't see interference in principle if you were able to make such an experiment. Okay, just a comment. The square dependence comes from the identity of particles. In the JLW model, there was only a linear increase of the size of the system. So it's interesting that how the symmetry of the wave function affects the collapse. Okay, so two values, lambda and RC, and I told you the meaning of that. So which phenomenological which values should we give to lambda and ERC and RC? Well, it's not so much clear because this, like with phenomenological models, you have to somehow to give a justification which is not always well grounded. So for ERC, for RC, there is a kind of agreement on the value. RC basically measures when the superposition is really macroscopic and should be collapsed or not. And so RC shouldn't be too small, otherwise you interfere with the internal structure of matter and you want to do that. RC shouldn't be too big, otherwise what you would call a macroscopic superposition wouldn't be collapsed by these models. So this value, the value for this parameter should be somehow in the mesoscopic range. And that's the choice that was made at the beginning and somehow everybody likes it in a way or another. You can, of course, play with the orders of magnitude plus or minus one, plus or minus two, but morally it's there. Regarding the collapse rate, instead, there is a disagreement in the literature. Two proposals have been put forward, the first by Girardi and the second one by Rimini and Weber, and the second one by Adler. And basically, that choosing lambda tells you where you want to put the quantum to classical transition. So we know that microscopic systems behave quantum mechanically. So lambda shouldn't be too strong. Otherwise, the models would be disproved already by experimental data. The microscopic world is quantum. You can choose to put the quantum to classical transition between the micro and the mesoscopic world, like Adler did. And in this way, if you do so, you would take lambda equal to that value, more or less. Again, you can play a little bit with the orders of magnitude, but that's more or less the value. Or you can be a bit more conservative and choose to put the quantum to classical transition between the meso and the macroscopic world. So everything is quantum, just when we come to the world that we see, we experience with our senses, the classicality emerges. And if you do so, then you take lambda equal to the original GRW value, 10 to the minus 16 or 17 seconds to the minus 1, something like that. So these are the two values. Somehow, this is the more or less, again, the strongest possible value that you can take for lambda, because as I will show you now, if you take it much stronger, then the models would be disproved by experimental evidence. This is somehow the weakest possible value that you can take for lambda, because if you take it much weaker, then collapse models wouldn't collapse the wave function of macroscopic objects in a short enough time. And then these models would lose the meaning. The only reason why people put forward these models is to make sure that the macro world behaves classically. So these are somehow the two extremes. There is a huge difference, some 9 orders of magnitude, which tells you that actually not much is known, also experimentally, about mesoscopic world. Does it behave quantum mechanically regarding superposition principle, of course, or does it behave classically? No one knows, and the people are testing that, to which extent it is true.
Sorry, can I ask?
Yes.
Did I understand right? You've more or less fixed RC at 10 to minus
yes.
1 centimeter for this discussion, and then said this is the range lambda.
Right.
I understand there's good reason not to take RC much smaller, but is there any good reason not to take RC much larger and use different values of lambda?
It's not easy to answer your question because it's a part of the project I'm working on. So the answer is not clear mathematically. Physically, the physical answer typically people give is that if RC is too big, then you do not effectively collapse the wave function. And if you take, so to compensate that, you can take lambda stronger, and then you create problems. But no one really analyzed that mathematically, and there's something that I still have to do, and I will do it in the near future. So the answer is not really clear, the answer to that.
I don't really understand the full
premise. Yes. That is indeed the case. And ask me the question in 6 months, and hopefully I'll give you the answer now.
Just getting that feeling, so to say. So if you change that from 100 nanometers to a micrometer, would that change the lambda by, again, an order of magnitude, or does that scale non-linearly?
I do not have the answer to that precisely, because, for example, for your experiments, I really don't know the nice theoretical formula for the, for example, the Fraunhofer diffraction given by collapse models. So far, all experiments depend on most experiments depend on the product lambda alpha. So if you increase alpha by one order of magnitude, then you decrease lambda. But whether this is the case also for your type of experiments, I mean, if I have to guess, I would say so, but I don't have the answer, the mathematical answer to that. So I really don't know. Okay, so now we come to the comparison with experimental data. And basically, there are two strategies that one can follow. Either you compare these models with the very accurate laboratory experiments, or you do cosmology. The collapse effects are small and tiny. But then, so you take the biggest possible system. You take the universe. The universe also lived for a long time. So this collapse effect had the time to build up and change the history of the universe. And you compare the prediction with the cosmological observation, and there is something interesting that comes from that. So let's start from laboratory experiments. And of course, the king of experiments is the double slit experiment, conceptually speaking. That's if you want to test the superposition principle, you create a superposition and you see whether or not there is interference. I will not spend much time about that because Marcus will spend 1.5 hours on Wednesday, right, talking more or less about these experiments. And I hope I have correctly updated the last experiment. So they start in 1999 with the fullerene, and now they are up to these large molecules with the 10,000 atomic mass units. The picture is taken from the original Nature paper about the C60. So what's the moral? Again, as I said, a mathematically precise analysis of the predictions of collapse models for this type of experiment is lacking. But, the moral is known somehow. And the moral is the following, and the mathematical analysis I don't think will change much. The bounds are somehow 2 orders of magnitude away from the value given by Adler. So if we come back, no, this way, if we come back to this picture, the experiment, the matter wave experiments in Vienna tell you that lambda cannot be stronger than this. Any such value, any of these values is okay, but these ones are ruled out by experimental data. So that means an upper bound. And it's a good news, actually, because two orders of magnitude is not much. And then they will cover it in 2 weeks, right?
3 years.
3 years. In 3 years, and they will be able to really make an experiment which will test the idea of Adler about the collapse rate. So whether the transition occurs between the micro and the mesoscopic world or at a later stage or never really. And so these are the future experiments. So going up to 10 to the 6 atomic mass units that we will talk about. I just mentioned some other strategies. So with macro mirrors and nanospheres. So here the strategy is the opposite. Not start with the small system and trying to make the superposition for bigger and bigger system, or starting already with the big system and trying to make to create a superposition. And there are a lot of technological difficulties. And so far, they are at the stage of the proposal. I mean, they have some intermediate goals. But the final goal of creating superposition has not been reached yet. And people are talking about doing these interference experiments also in space for, in order to increase the size of the system. But you will hear about that by Marcus and on Wednesday. So this is the direct way of testing. And so there is an indirect way, which is also very interesting. And it's a pity that Philip Pearl is not here yet, because he worked also on that. So the indirect way is the process of spontaneous photon emission. Take a charged particle, which is a free particle. In quantum mechanics, nothing really interesting happens. According to collapse models, the particle is not really free because there is this noise that creates a Brownian motion that kicks the particle back and forth. It's charged, so it emits radiation. So you have a prediction of collapse models that radiation is emitted from matter. So everything here, also us, emit radiation because there is this noise which excites the protons and the electrons. Then you can compute the emission rate. Of course, it's very small. You can compute the emission rate with the CSL formula. This has been done to first perturbative order, first by a student of Fu, the Fu student of Philip Pearl in 1997. And this is the theoretical prediction for the CSL model. And for the free particle, that's for the hydrogenic atom done by Steve Adler and collaborators. And actually, this is from the point of view of theoretical physics, this is a really interesting problem because it's QED, so quantum electrodynamics, with the noise, with the background noise. It's very interesting to solve the equation, and many subtleties come out, and one can learn a lot about quantum field theory, actually, by this simple example. But the moral is that you have a prediction of an emission rate. You can compare the theoretical prediction with experimental data, and you have something surprising. So there is no good experimental data. There is just data taken from some other type of experiments. These refer actually to some neutrinoless double beta decay experiment. Basically, you have a piece of germanium in an underground facility, so no noise somehow. You put a detector and you see whether photons come out. And then you see that the theoretical prediction is stronger than higher than the experimental result. So in one way, one can say that the CSL model is disproved. I'm talking here about the theoretical prediction is about the weak value given by Girardi, Rimini and Weber. So
let me understand this. So this is applying the CSL to the electrons in the atom, but not to the electromagnetic field directly, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the electrons are excited and emit radiation.
And they are coupled with the electromagnetic
field, but
whose Hamiltonian has not been modified in CSL.
No, the Hamiltonian for the electromagnetic field is the standard quantum Hamiltonian. CSL affects only the electrons.
Because in principle, what you want to do is also put the effect of CSL for the Hamiltonian, but then the question would be...
I would say that... I would say that possible CSL correction to light would become relevant only I don't know when, actually. I would say at the relativistic level, but light is always relativistic. So I don't know, at very high energies, probably something like that. But at these regimes, I wouldn't think that collapse effect on...
One doesn't know even what put there. You're assuming that it's proportional to...
Oh, no, I mean the reasonable way of doing that is, well, mathematically, you just write the collapse equation also for the photon states. And for,
what do you do for lambda?
For lambda, I would use the mass energy equivalence relation. So given lambda for a proton, I would like, or for electron, I would like the corresponding, I would write the corresponding lambda for a photon, so depending on the frequency, and would be a very small, because it's C at the denominator would be. It would be, I mean, that's the reasonable thing to do. So if lambda goes with the mass for matter, it would go with the energy for light. So any other choice would be kind of, suspicious, if not unreasonable. Yes?
Is there anything that makes it clear that you have to do it ever?
No. So from the conceptual point of view of solving the measurement problem, so to say, there is no need of collapsing light.
You could have a consistent theory where some particles collapse and others don't.
That is true, but that's the, so to say, the solving the measurement problems perspective.
Right.
But if you take the perspective that the nature is nonlinear and stochastic, and so matter goes that way, then you would wonder why shouldn't also light. It's a very physical point of view, so forget the foundations of quantum mechanics. Really physical intuition.
Right.
Why shouldn't light go that way also?
Right.
There is this field, why shouldn't it couple to matter?
Right. But I mean, it's not, let's put it this way. There's nothing either from the standpoint of mathematical consistency or from the standpoint of solving the measurement problem that requires you to do this.
Yes,
right.
Agreed.
Peculiarity that all the energies end in one.
It's not. I don't know. That's the tech. That was a. I don't know why they end in one. I'm really. I just read the table. I don't know. I was a detector set. That I can. I'm sorry. I cannot answer to that question.
I'm curious.
And you're right. So the point is the following one. So that experiment tells that all these values are ruled out. The strong value of Adler, the weak value of Girardi. If you read it, so the first way to read it. So the original, if you want to be picky, the original CSL, the original CSL model is disproved. But then, I mean, no one was worried. I mean, Girardi was not worried, Philip Pearl was not worried. Because the original CSL model coming from the GRW model assumed that there is only one universal lambda which applies to all type of particles. But that's not reasonable. If you think of how the amplification mechanism works, that the stronger, the bigger the system, the stronger the collapse, then you would say also that the collapse rate for a proton should be stronger than the collapse rate of for an electron, because a proton is heavier than an electron. That's within the economy of collapse models, that's the natural way of doing that. So you would take a lambda for different types of particles, not one lambda per particle, but only for type of particles. So one lambda for neutrinos, one lambda for electrons, one lambda for protons, going with the mass of the system. So you have the mass proportional CSL model. And if you use the mass proportional CSL model, then in the original formula, the mass of the electron gets replaced with the mass of a nucleon squared. And you decrease...
mass proportional is mass proportional squared.
Yeah, it's because, I mean, you... The first term goes with the square root of lambda. The first term, that this is for lambda. So it's squared, yes. In the collapse equation, there is the first term goes with the square root and the second term with lambda. So you decrease the prediction by 6 orders of magnitude and you restore compatibility with experimental data. So the CSL model is in the more natural way is valid. For the weak value.
But for positronium, then it could be.
For positronium, I don't know what happens. Because
you replace again the mass of the neutron by the electron.
Yeah, but then that will come at the end to this point. This is the asymptotic formula for taking going to infinity. So you're assuming that your system is stable. Positronium is not stable. So then you have to, for short times, you will never see anything. What about the strong value of Adler? Still, with the mass proportional CSL model, the strong value of Adler is disproved by 2 orders of magnitude. Adler is wrong. And that's why Adler started working with noise, a colored noise instead of white noise, to see whether things change. The white noise is a very nice mathematical tool, but it's not physically reasonable that all frequencies, also extremely large frequencies, are there with the same weight. It's not a physical noise. There should be a cutoff. So what the question was, what happens when you introduce a cutoff? And then actually the formula changes. It becomes, oh, again, to first order. It becomes, in perturbation theory, the formula for the color noise is the formula for the white noise times the Fourier transform of the correlation function of the noise. So if the noise has a cutoff, then you kill the emission rate. And that's what happens, actually. I'm coming. Even if you take kind of reasonable cutoffs, this is a typical... So a typical cosmological cutoff, so for the background radiation, microwave background radiation, or the gravitational background radiation, is about 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 Hertz. So you can take it even something larger, 10 to the 15 and 10 to the 18, much larger than typical cosmological cutoffs, and you still have a good compatibility with experimental data. But you need to go to a color noise. Yes.
I'm trying to understand whether this seems like it's a reasonable way to rescue a really important hypothesis, or a sort of desperate way. And I guess I didn't understand why did Adler want the stronger value? Was there
the reason of Adler? Okay, so the motivation which is given in his paper is the following. Collapse models are meant to solve the measurement problem. So they are meant to destroy superposition, basically, in any measurement situation. Or I'm saying according to his view, and we can object to that. So anything that you would somehow call a measurement, in anything that you, any time that something that you would call a measurement occurs, the wave function collapses in a reasonable time. That's what it would say. So take the process of latent image formation. You have a film, photographic film. You have the superposition of some photons, 5, 10, whatever the resolution, the sensitivity of the film is, coming in one direction or another direction. Then you have the superposition of chemical reaction going on here or going on there, registering the position where the photon hit the screen. He says that, he claims that this is a measurement. The measurement is not me developing the film, me seeing that. That's not a measurement. The real measurement is that one, the latent image formation, because I can place the film in a dark drawer for 1 year and develop the film 1 year after and see the position. So it's unreasonable, although logically consistent, it's unreasonable to think that the measurement is when I open the drawer. The measurement took place at that time. So that's a measurement. I want the wave function to collapse for that measurement. With the JW value, that doesn't happen. So I have to take a lambda stronger.
So that's his view.
Best way I can reproduce his view.
If it's not unreasonable to ask you to sort of comment, what do you think of that view?
I think it's reasonable. I think it's reasonable in a way. I wouldn't know whether in the process of latent image formation really I need the collapse of the wave function, but somehow, yes, I tend to sympathize towards Adler's view. You know, the JW view was the most conservative choice that you could make. That I understand why they made it, because they were afraid that the day after you write the equation, someone proves that it's wrong because of contradiction with experimental data. So they took the most conservative value. I think that GRW value is too weak. It cannot be the right value. It's really the weakest possible value to make sense of collapse models. Why shouldn't it be like that? I think that truth is either in between or more towards Adler's suggestion. It's if you want, for me now, probably Girard would kill me, but for me, his view at the end of the day is a kind of an anthropocentric. His value, not the view, no, he hasn't such a view. His value is a kind of anthropocentric value. So everything is quantum, but not what we see.
Okay.
That would be the JW value.
I'm intrigued, but maybe we should discuss later.
Yeah. So in that sense, I'm more sympathetic towards Adler's idea, but I really don't know what the value is. You have no other intuition than that. So that's the moral about Adler's value. But you see, there is in a way a good news. Collapse models can be tested experimentally, and at least the first naive ideas have been disproven. So these models are not just fiction somehow. They can get in contact with the experiment. The bad, I don't know if the bad side of the story is that regarding the radiation problem, the theoretical formula is very much model dependent. So if you change the model, you change the formula. So when you make the experiment, you are just testing some specific model, not really collapse models. And then, as I will argue at the end, actually the only type of experiments that morally do that, and I say morally because I don't have the mathematical proof, are the double slit or matter wave experiments. So that's so basically these are the real experiments for testing collapse models in their generality. Okay, so let's come now to cosmology a little bit. I'm not an expert in that, so I will be fast. So energy non-conservation. As I said, the energy increases in the CSL model because this noise heats particles up. The rate is extremely small. So you can, I don't know if you put it in a thermodynamical way, as the temperature increases 10 to the minus 15 Kelvin per year. So it's negligible somehow, but still, I mean, the universe is quite old in a way. And you can put some bounds. And this has been done by Steve Adler. He was the one who did such an analysis. He considered different structures in the universe of free protons or cosmic hydrogen, intergalactic medium, and so on and so forth. All these structures in the universe heat up because of the collapse effect, and then they are not too hot if you look at the sky. And then you put bounds, and these are the upper bounds, refer to the weak GRW value, so they are very bad bounds. And these are the same upper bounds with reference to the Adler's value, and they are quite, I mean, this is quite strong, actually, in some sense. But again, Adler's idea is barely compatible with the cosmological observations. And probably you can disprove it if you do a very well refined analysis. But again, there is also one problem here, that this refers to the CSL model where the energy increases linearly. You can include dissipative effects. That makes sense, that the energy doesn't increase. It goes to saturation. There is this noise, which has a temperature. Systems go to the temperature of the noise. And then you change the entire prediction, and probably these bounds become extremely weak. And also, I want to point out also this, so just some advertisement for the people working on inflation and so on and so forth. There is this open question of how the cosmic structure of the universe emerges from a perfectly symmetric initial state. It's an open problem in cosmology. And there are the possibilities that collapse breaks such a symmetry and gives so explains this again, what is called quantum to classical transition in the framework of inflationary cosmology. And in general, how does the early stages of the universe change if nonlinear effects are present in the quantum evolution? And then you see this literature. There are quite a number of people now working on this. It's an interesting topic, actually. Okay, so I come to it's time to come to a kind of a summary. So these are the known upper bounds for the CSL model, referring to Adler's value, laboratory experiments, cosmological data. Some are good, again, some are bad. So that's the technology can really say something, already said something, actually. But again, I want to stress this point, that this table should not be read in too a naive way. Most bounds depend, as I said before, on the way you construct the model. And so far, this is the one that really probably is strong against changing the noise or changing the type of operator in which of basis or where you collapse. I want to, so that's the more. I want to just to tell you something about something new that we worked on. It's something simple in a way. When I was at Perimeter here the first time, like some 5-6 years ago, and I gave a talk about collapse models, there was Joy Christian who told me that you forgot a type of experiment for testing collapse models, which is the one with neutrinos. There is a paper on PRL where it claims that neutrinos can be a test of a Penrose idea for gravity-induced collapse models. Well, I mean, it's Joy Christian is not here, but I mean, the paper is not trustable in a way because it uses the Diozzi-Penrose model in a way which should not be done. So we redid the calculation. So inspired by that, we redid the calculation using the CSL model, which doesn't have the problems of the Diozzi-Penrose model. And actually, we got the answer that we expected. For neutrinos, you see that lambda t, so collapse plus time. I mean, the moral is that neutrinos are small, so you shouldn't be able to test collapse there. But they weakly interact with matter, and they can travel extremely long distances for a long time through the universe. So perhaps there is the hope that the collapse effect builds up there. Well, I mean, the answer is no. This effect is ridiculous, basically zero. So no hope to test CSL effect with neutrinos. So since we started doing this, we did also with mesons. That you see that larger system, stronger collapse, but still.
What is what you look for?
Oh, the neutrino oscillations are damped because of the, it's like a decoherence effect, if you want. Neutrino oscillations are damped because of the collapse effect.
But if neutrino, if the things that collapse are the eigenstates of the mass of the neutrino.
That's an indirect effect, yes. So you have the CSL model which collapses in space, but as an indirect effect, you have the damping of the oscillations as well.
But doesn't it depend on what things do you decide, which neutrinos do you decide to collapse? The mass eigenstates or the flavor eigenstates?
No, I mean, we take the CSL model, which goes with the mass, so with the mass eigenstates. You use the standard CSL model. Of course, I mean, the collapse goes in, with the mass, depends on the mass. You can make a collapse model, but that's not the CSL model. We apply, in a strict way, the CSL model to neutrinos.
Because before you were saying when you were going to apply the photons, you were going to use the energy.
Mass
eigenstates are not necessarily energy eigenstates.
Well, we use an approximate value for the mass. I mean, that doesn't change. I mean, that changes a little bit, but the order of magnitude is the one here.
Yeah.
Then with kaons, the effect is stronger, but still, I mean, out of reach. And with chiral molecules, actually, in principle, you could say something. But again, the problem is the coherence here to be. But it's just interesting because, I mean, what's the point if you want? Here, these are naturally oscillating quantum systems. So you could say that you don't have to prepare a superposition in a lab like Marcus has to do. Quantum mechanics gives you, or nature gives you, this oscillation for free. You don't have to prepare them. So you just take them and you observe them. And the answer is that actually, I mean, you cannot do much with that.
It's very important to see what you're observing. For example, in the neutral kaons, which is what I think you're considering, one should be very careful if you're going to apply the model, to decide whether the model goes with the mass eigenstate, momentum eigenstate,
mass,
energy eigenstate. Before you were, if I extrapolate from what you were saying in the case of photons, it should be the energy eigenstate, which is very close to the mass, but it's not exactly the same. And the point is that in all the experiments with kaons, one sees only interference of energy eigenstates. There has not been any experiment in the kaons in which you don't see energy eigenstates. So there will be no damping.
We do have to talk later about that. But I mean, I don't think that the numbers would change much. Still, we have to talk about that. Okay, so I want just to conclude about gravity. So I mainly talked about the CSL model, but now there is some quite excitement about gravity-induced collapse. And there have been two things which have been done in the literature, independently somehow, one not completely one from the other, and sometimes people confuse them. One is the Schrödinger-Newton equation, one is the Diozzi-Penrose model. The Schrödinger-Newton equation, morally, if not even in a strict mathematical sense, somehow, comes from the semi-classical gravity, where you have classical gravity with quantum matter. And then somehow, in some precise way, the Schrödinger-Newton equation comes out. So Schrödinger free particle, and then you have the Newtonian part, where the different parts of the wave function interact among themselves. So this is a very nice equation, actually. It's a nonlinear equation. It is. So you would say it induces the collapse. But even that is not clear. There is the group of Giulini working on that and doing some precise analysis. In a way, the wave function collapses in the sense that it shrinks at short times. It's not clear what happens for long times. Does it remain collapsed? And the analysis, moreover, the analysis has been done for a Gaussian wave packet. If you have the superposition of two Gaussian wave packets, what happens? No one knows about that, because this has not been analyzed. It's a nonlinear equation, so you cannot use your intuition in a naive way. For example, some numerical analysis that he showed last 2 weeks ago in Germany, showed that the Gaussian wave function collapses, but then there is kind of a back reaction, and part of the wave function explodes away. Does it really go away? Does it come back? Does it vanish? No one knows. So it's very interesting to analyze. Anyway, one has to be clear that this is not a collapse equation in the sense of solving the measurement problem, because so we don't know whether it collapses the wave function first, but certainly the wave function does not collapse in the right way. And moreover, it's a linear deterministic, nonlinear deterministic equation that allows for superluminal signaling. So it cannot be considered in any way whatsoever a fundamental equation. its status is not clear. The Diozzi-Penrose model instead is has a completely different structure. This is a, I wrote it for the density matrix, but you can write it for the wave function. It has a Lindblad structure, so it's a good equation in the sense that it doesn't do anything crazy. It really collapses the wave function in space. And it's somehow gravity-inspired, because here you have the 1 over r dependent Newtonian potential and something like that. But again, it's not completely nice, because in this equation, you have a divergence because of the, again, when you go to zero, when you integrate and you go for with r equal to r prime, you diverge. Here, there is no such divergence. So really, there are two different things. These are. So you have to introduce a cutoff. Diozzi, when he proposed the equation, knew about that. And he said, I put a cutoff. I mean, this is a non-relativistic equation. So of course, he put a cutoff. At short distances, things break down. And he suggested a cutoff equal to the size of a proton, of a nucleon. It's a very nice thing to do. And if that were the case, there would be a wonderful equation, because basically there is no extra parameter. There is only G. There is no lambda, no alpha, no nothing. But indeed, Girardi, Riemann, and Weber proved that with such a short cutoff, the model is inconsistent, because the energy increase is too strong. The model is disproven by experimental data. And incidentally, the reason why Joe Christian in his paper could show that with this equation somehow implies that the collapse effects are testable with neutrinos was precisely because it took a very small cutoff. And for such a small cutoff, the effect is very strong. But then the model is inconsistent. And if in order to restore consistency with experimental data, you have to take a very large cutoff equal to the RC value of Girardi, Riemann, and Weber, 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, which makes the model somehow less appealing. There is no reason. I mean, this is a gravity-inspired model, and there is no reason why the cutoff should be so large. So the equation is good, certainly. It's a good equation. But still, I mean, it's not the end of the story, even within the framework of collapse models. One has still to understand what's going on, if really the idea of collapse induced by gravity is the correct one. Okay, yeah, so
basically, I guess... What's V there, the volume of a proton?
Yeah, so that's the peculiarity, of this thing. So this is a mass operator, so to say, that describes the mass distribution of your system. So for a spherical mass distribution, you have mass, volume, and then you have the theta function that defines the mass over a sphere of radius r. So if you model the proton as a sphere, this would be the mass of the proton, the volume of the proton, the radius of the proton. But if you use this and you plug it into that, the proton would heat up immediately and become very hot in a short time. But in fact, when people discuss this Penrose's idea, usually you talk about a large enough system and you make a homogeneous mass distribution assumption. So you take a baseball here and a baseball there. So this is the mass of the baseball, the volume of the baseball, and the radius of the baseball. And everything works. But then one has to remember that the baseball is made of neutrons, of nucleons. And then when you do such a microscopic analysis, everything breaks down. Yeah.
Is there a reason why your first equation is one dimensional and x?
Oh, no, just for simplicity. No, you can write a three-dimensional without any problem. Okay, so that was the end of it. And I want to thank people and institutions who are giving me money.